coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody. Sorry for the pauses there. We are having a couple of technical difficulties with our guest, getting them into the Zoom system, so he will be on via audio this evening. We are joined in the first segment by Stephen Myers from the Ferris Pump Foundation. We'll be talking about the scans, the synthetic aperture radar Doppler tomography scans that were done on the Khafre Pyramid recently. If you go to curiousrealm.com/knowledge/studies, the first PDF that you will see there is the official PDF that was released regarding this. We will be talking about the data as it stands thus far. We will be talking about some of the misunderstandings. I think some of the real misgivings when it comes to the technology used for this. And I know Stephen Myers has been chomping at the bit and chomping all over the place on social media about it. Welcome back to the show, Stephen Myers. How are you doing this evening, my friend?
Well, I'm doing great, and I'm glad to be back on your show. What an honor it is. Sorry about the technical difficulties, but It'll work out,
you know, and, you know, it especially happens. I have been saying I am woefully going to be missing my Skype. We have connected with you. You're one of the guests that we've connected with via Skype for the longest time. So, yeah,
yes.
It's one of those where we're using a new system, using Zoom and things like that. And for some reason, it did not want to cooperate. So we are on via voice tonight. Welcome back to the show. How have things been going with the Ferris Pump Foundation before we get started with all of this hubbub that's been going on social media? How has your research been going? How have things been going with the foundation?
Things are going really good. I've actually dropped my third book about the Great Pyramid, and it's rather technical, but that's okay. It is called Pharaoh's Pump Analyzed, and I would have shown you the cover of the book, but such is life, you know, with all this technical stuff. But anyway, it's another book on the same direction of research that I'm following.
We have it up on the screen right now.
Oh, great. Yeah, you're way ahead of me. We also did a tour to Egypt. I co-led a tour over there, so it's been a couple of years ago now, and had a great time, visited all the sites, including the Aswan High Dam and the Great Pyramid, Giza Plateau, and the KFC right next to the
right
to the Giza Plateau and everything else. So we had a great time. So a lot is going on, and certainly there's been some recent scans of the Giza Plateau. It's primarily under the Khafre Pyramid.
Yeah.
So that's the topic of the day.
Well, and it's been once again all over social media. I believe me, folks, I am excited. I think it's got some amazing potential. Don't get me wrong, but as I always say, like review. It's time for peer review. It's time for these things to go through all that kind of stuff. So, what is your opinion on the data as it stands thus far?
Well, I'll tell you, but first I need to tell the audience a little bit about myself. I have a highly technical background. My education and vocational experiences centered around various types of high technology. My degree is in fluid dynamics, and I hold the FCC commercial class radio telephone license. I'm a licensed amateur radio operator. I have a number of certifications, qualifications regarding working in electronics and related fields. You know, I've worked with high voltage electricity, long distance radio communications, mechanical and electrical control systems, communication systems, machinery, design, feedback control systems, and a bunch of other things. So with that technical background, I think I have some insight into these very recent scans that have come out regarding the Giza Plateau. As you say, they're synthetic aperture radar Doppler tomography scans. And they've certainly been around the world and back the results, if you will, on YouTube and Facebook. There's all these images that have been created and that type of thing. So it's certainly been an interesting couple of weeks, to be sure.
Oh, absolutely, man. And you know, it has been a rousing couple weeks with everything there, to say the least. It is been fascinating to see the communities light up about it, which of course they are prone to do. But once again, with synthetic aperture radar, I've got everything up from NASA right here from their website. And it goes through all the math, everything else, especially through limestone, through a medium such as that, you do not get a great deal of penetration off of synthetic aperture radar.
That's correct.
So go ahead.
It's just feet of depth of penetration in rock, feet or tens of feet, if you will.
Yep.
Maybe even 100 feet. So your thought about review is really hits the nail on the top of the head. What my issue is not the results. That's something different. But what my issue is the whole process from beginning to end, the research methods used to come up with these crystal clear images and even some of the blurry pictures. So I have a lot of issues with that. And that's one of them, is the lack of depth of penetration to collect data points to analyze. But the scan project has a go around for that. They're using software that is proprietary that they analyze their data, but there's no data below, let's say, 100 feet to analyze. So they use this proprietary software and come up with some results, and that's a big question. Well, you know, that is not real science.
Well, and you know, I will say, especially with the proprietary software, things like that, basically what they're doing is measuring Doppler shift in something, and Doppler anomaly specifically is what they state in their work. And it's interesting to me that the use of Doppler tomography, basically ground penetrating radar of its own form, but that in and of itself only through limestone only goes about 50 feet. So they're talking about measuring these small seismic changes that happen in the ground underneath and comparing it to overhead satellite imagery of SAR and combining the two and comparing the anomaly. And that's where they get this. And once again, I don't know. Maybe I don't understand the technology well enough. But to me, it seems kind of flawed to be using to be using the anomaly as the proof. You know,
that's a good way to put it. What they do is, let me say this: if the software is proprietary, then the process cannot be peer reviewed. Okay.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because you can't see it; it's proprietary. So, but we'll see. You know, we'll see in the coming weeks, in the coming months, and years how things go. So that's an issue. And another issue is the, and you'll understand this, the relationship between signal and noise. The signal is the what they would say is anomalies. And the noise is just background noise. I don't mean audio noise. I mean interference, if you will.
Yeah.
So they're getting these scans from satellites. So you got just a little bit of signal, but a lot of, not audio, but background interference, if you will.
Yeah.
Okay. What they're measuring is, what do they call it? Micro movements? Is that what they're calling it?
That is what they're calling it. Micro seismic vibration and movements.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I've been to the Giza Plateau, and if you're ever there, it is always got micro movements or whatever they want to call it because of massive buses, people stomping around, trucks coming and going, and you can walk from the Great Pyramid easily to Cairo. Actually, Giza is like a subdivision, if you want to put it that way. But what I mean is there's trucks, highways, and everything all around the Giza Plateau, massive buses stopping and starting within feet of the front of the Great Pyramid. So the amount of noise of micro movements is really high compared to the signal, if you will. So that's an issue that needs to be resolved.
Yeah. Yeah. And, we've talked about some pretty massive concepts on this show, you and I, Stephen, when it comes to creation of the pyramids, how they were possibly built, what they were possibly built for, the idea of them being used to basically help pump water to the Giza Plateau to help keep it alive. Things like that. But the idea of there being a complex, and granted, we know that it's connected to a reservoir underneath, right?
Well, yeah, there are some underground passages and chambers below the Great Pyramid, but this is more specific to the Khafre Pyramid, the pyramid right next to the Great Pyramid.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that there was a cavern rediscovered by Andrew Collins and other folks a few years ago, things like that. What are the odds of this being something along those lines, Stephen?
Well, the Giza Plateau over the eons has passages and caves and tunnels all through it. So there's a lot of that under the Great Pyramid, 100 feet down. There's the subterranean chamber, but using this scan with just the few processes that you and I question in their research methods, and there are more. So, but just talking about this, to have columns that are twice as tall as the Eiffel Tower and these coil springs that look like big pogo sticks, if you will. Remember them when you jump on them? And to come up with all of this crystal clear, dimensionally accurate features and a subterranean city is certainly beyond the scope of the ability of the process they're using to scan beneath the Giza Plateau. So I think that the probability of these things that they claim are there is at zero. Those features are not there.
Yeah.
They do not exist.
Once again, I think that there may be a large cavern, something like that, underneath. I would not doubt that one bit. However, I don't think that we are looking at any kind of technology on that realm. Like you're saying, the images that they have put forth are entirely too detailed for literally measuring something via anomaly. You know?
Yeah, a boxer would say they're leading by the chin, if you will. And there's a lot of hokum, I would say, involved in how they manipulate the data, because the software is proprietary, but also they use AI to come up with whatever they want to come up with. So there's a lot of problems with it. And even in the paper, probably the paper you're quoting, I can't see, but they say that the Great Pyramid is made out of granite when it's the Great Pyramid is, 99% limestone. So, just these little errors are red flags type of thing. So, it's there and everything, the use of AI as sort of a magic wand to come up with what they want to come up with is really, really odd and that type of thing. So it's just a strange phenomenon that this has taken off, gained a life of its own, if you will.
And, it truly has.
That type of thing. I think it's Mark Twain who said that a lie can travel around the world before the truth can get its pants on.
Yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say?
Well,
it's odd.
Well, and what would be the vested interest, scientifically, study-wise, money-wise, Stephen, to getting this out? Because I can't say that Zahi Hawass and the Museum of Antiquities are gonna hop, skip, and jump to go start digging around and finding this, if that's the case. What is the vested interest in getting this out in that kind of way?
Well, I don't know. There's also, you mentioned money and everything else, but there's also ego, prestige, and that type of thing. So, but it's strange. But you mentioned Zahi Hawass, who, I'm not a big fan of by any means. There was another scan, the Pyramid Scan Project, using muon technology. And that was, 15 or 10 years ago? They discovered, making a long story short, they discovered an anomaly above the Grand Gallery.
Yep.
And they also found an anomaly above the original entrance. And they didn't say the exact dimensions. They were very conservative in what the muon scan could produce. They were very open to show how the process of collection data and how the data was analyzed. They were very open about that. And their conclusion was, we think there's an anomaly above the Grand Gallery and one by the opening of the Great Pyramid. Well, they did do a little bit of excavation. They drilled a hole and put a camera into that anomaly above the opening of the Great Pyramid, and they took pictures and everything. And so there's no need for peer review. It's proven that anomaly that the muon scan produced actually hit a feature of the Great Pyramid. So that gives credence to the accuracy of that scan. So research kind of travels slowly, if you will, but there was just a, it didn't take much excavation
Yeah.
And it was a chamber that had never been opened before. So it was, quite interesting, to say the least. So it was, that's they call that the North Face Corridor. And so that's that. But on this other thing, I don't think there's a justification to dig down beneath the Khafre Pyramid based on this scan to find these columns that are taller than twice as tall as the Eiffel Tower. I mean, they're just making this stuff up. And it's almost like a psyops, if you will, to keep everyone away from real research. I mean, it's just so utterly bizarre.
Well, it really is. It reminds me a lot of, it reminds me a whole lot of the Jersey drone situation, Stephen, and when that hit and the sensationalism with which it hit. And how, and I mean, we did a whole episode on how it was dividing the community, it came down to some people to the point of like angels versus demons, my friend. And it happened rapidly. And it was just one of those like, wow. Look at how this is affecting the community right now. And look at the way that people are taking this as though it's 100% fact with almost no backup data to go along with it. Right. I am all about a muon study. I loved the muon study whenever I heard about it because, there was already work being done in the field of muon detection. Things like that. This was already being considered for other things. So when they put it to work in the pyramid, I thought that was really awesome. And they truly, truly did come up with some beautiful data, that stands out.
Very conservative about what it was. They didn't tell you.
Absolutely.
They didn't say there's statues inside this hidden chamber or anything like that. Just that they were very, like I say, conservative, but this other thing, it's just strange.
Yeah, no, it's been utterly strange to see it evolve, to see it grow its own legs, to see AI videos start coming out of people walking around in the bottom and taking measurements and things like that. And it's like, this is AI.
It's completely
safe. It happened in rapid succession within a day or two. Those things started coming out and that's right. Just it. When that it's starts on. Happening, you. Like for you, I saw you immediately, hut to and get after it, man, because it's one of those, we have to be careful, once again, we have talked some very interesting hypothesis and theory on this show, Stephen, but I don't think either one of us are talking anything that can't be backed up with some sort of science, and that's when you're talking about structures, once again, the size of the Eiffel Tower, numerous underneath there with detailed images, things like that. You have to wonder and you have to be careful with how that data is accrued, how that data is gathered, because it's all too easily falsified and all too easily misleading,
It seems to be. I put a few things on Facebook and I've been eviscerated. Well, how can you know? Yeah. How do you know? And all this other stuff. But they said, well, it's been proven. How is it proven? They say, oh, well, it's proven by a peer review. Uh-oh. If that's all you got is peer review, that's a red flag. On the Muon project, they got pictures, photographs inside of that chamber they discover. But peer review is the least authentic and the least accurate type of proof you could ever come up with.
Sure.
Let me tell you why. They found the Piltdown skull. It was about a mile from Darwin's back door. If you walked about a mile from Darwin's back door in a gravel pit, they found the Piltdown skull. The best anthropologist in the world. Oh, there it is. You know, they accepted it as fast as all these people accept these scans. It's proof. How do we know it's proof? It's true. Well, all us experts agree that it is. And everything Zuhi Hawass says and everything Egyptologists say is validated with peer review. Oh, there it is. It's valid. Whatever they say.
Yeah.
A peer review, if that's all you got, I mean, if that's all you got, it's a type of circular reasoning. You think something is true. You go to the experts that think it's true and you ask them, is it true? And they say, yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
That's a circular reasoning. It's also another type of logical fallacy, peer review, and that is it is an appeal to authority.
Sure.
Let's say an Egyptologist comes up with some story that is that is consistent with what Egyptologists think. So he goes to other Egyptologists. Oh, do you agree with this stuff that you think is true? Yeah, we agree with it. So peer review, when they say, well, these scans are validated by peer review, even though they can't analyze the proprietary software, it's a big red flag, to be sure. So it takes a lot more than peer review. Another way that these scans are considered to be proven is that the scans were used on the Osiris shaft on the Giza Plateau. Okay. And supposedly, the scans saw the Osiris shaft. Well, the Osiris shaft is, what, 100, 150 feet deep? And then they're comparing that with 2,000-foot deep features that supposedly the scans are seeing. That type of logical fallacy is called the issue of scale, if you will. Okay? You know what I'm trying to say? Let me put an example.
Please.
I can say, well, I can lift a full-size car up over my head. Just grab it and lift it. And I can prove that process by lifting a Hot Wheels car over my head. Okay? Not very good proof, because the demonstration is flawed because of an issue of scale.
Yeah.
So they say, well, we can see the Osiris shaft, which is at most 150 feet deep. So that proves we can see 2,000 feet underground. See? So all of this stuff has taken off with a life of its own, but when people are really going to start examining it, they're going to say, well, or some people just believe it as an act of faith, but real researchers are going to take issue with all of these processes involved in these supposedly clear scans that actually originally produced fuzzy, blurry pictures. So we'll see how it all plays out.
Well, and you know, once again, it's the fact of synthetic aperture radar does not reach that far into limestone. The depth only goes a few meters down for synthetic aperture radar, and even Doppler tomography, which is a form of ground penetrating radar, only goes to about 50 feet. So
yes,
even if you are combining the two, you're looking at maybe 60 feet with any kind of resolution, you know?
Yeah.
So to be, and granted, I guess adding in the seismic motion data and things like that. But I don't think, once again, that just with the seismic motion data being added, that you are going to go, let me bring up, some of these images once again of the tomography, things like that. You are not going to go from these images, which are very radar centric. You know, you can make out what they are if you know what you're looking at. You can make out what sort they of. Are if you're familiar with the layout of some of the places, you know, inside of the pyramid. However, if you're not intimately familiar with that, it would be hard to tell what this is, aside from the fact of, okay, this is something solid. You know, this is something with a differing density than the surrounding material, you know, things like that, being able to find an open void in material, that kind of stuff. It's not like you have dropped a LIDAR camera down there and gotten a millimeter precise laser radar image and a three-dimensional graphical display of what that location looks like. Even with adding the seismic data, I don't think you would be getting that kind of detail in the image.
It's all fake. And I think I'm calling this whole phenomenon Scanageddon, if you will, where you know, the world is under the power of Scanageddon. And it's going to, if I can say this, it's going to bite a lot of these alternative researchers in the ass, and it's going to become a litmus test in the not too distant future, where people that are kind of, you know, all these alternative researchers have their ideas and stuff, but you can ask them, well, were you duped into believing those fake scans? Those SAR scans, and you know, they can't hide it. You can look up their Facebook posts and everything. And if they did, then you know that researcher is an incompetent researcher and doesn't have a grasp on valid research methods.
Well,
and that's what this whole thing is proving. So many alternative researchers don't even understand research methods.
Yeah. I have been very happy to see people, the ilk of William Henry, Andrew Collins, Freddie Silva, and Graham Hancock, every one of them saying, I hope so, but there's still a lot to come in. There's still a lot of data that needs to be gone through. There is still a lot of proof of mathematics and things like that that has to happen in order for this to be, quote, evidence as opposed to just data, you know?
I do know.
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem, is that people are so ready to have something proven that they are willing to fully jump a shark, Stephen, to the point of proven in evidence instead of data and a field of data, you know? It's
right. But there's another point I want to make. You mentioned a lot of great guys that have been in this forever. But you and I have already, based on our understanding, based on our research methods, are already ahead of the curve, if you will, on understanding that the flaws of these scans are insurmountable. So in a way, you and I are ahead of the curve of Graham Hancock and all those other guys that you mentioned. They're still hedging their bets and sitting on the fence. So, you know, you should take some credit for your ability to ascertain the veracity of these scans and your courage to stake your reputation on it.
And thank you for that, Stephen. Thank you. Truth, because it's one of those, I pride myself on the fact of we may cover a topic like this that is in the headlines in the community. However, our goal is always to demystify these topics. To get rid of the hearsay, the conjecture, the false information that may be going on or that may be obfuscating the truth that might be there. And for me, it's the fact of there have been numerous telling moments in our communities over the last many years. Corey Good, you know, and the lawsuits and revelations that have come about from him and the secret space program. Things like that. There have been numerous defining moments like that. And I think that this is one of them where, like you said, come to shake things out, there's going to be a lot of people who may have some detriment to their name, sadly, if they fully hitch their wagon to what may be a very pumped up truth, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's a, well, it's, I wouldn't call it a truth by any means, but it's certainly information out there. But all researchers should do several things. One of them is to make a distinction between what is true and what is false.
Yes.
And that's what you and I are doing. And then when you press a lot of these researchers that embrace these scans and press them, you know, about, the research methods, the processes, the amount of poetic license they're using, if you can say that, to come up with their results, then they start saying, oh, well, we can't really know anything about anything. And I won't admit that I embrace those scans, but I actually do. And so you can't really pin me down on anything because nothing, we don't know anything for sure. So if you encounter a researcher like that, run away, because if their research can't determine the distinction between what is true and what isn't, then their research is both invalid and detrimental. So
yeah,
a lot of misinformation out there, and it's going to get worse with these AI videos that people. Oh well, yeah, you can just see it.
And the AI videos and the AI images, I mean, quite honestly, over my shoulder right now on video, I have AI images made for the show about topics, things like that. I use AI all the time to generate things, to make things. And the fact that those videos, once again, came in such rapid succession across the internet that it's hard not to see things as a flap nowadays when they happen. It's hard not to see things and the way that they immediately disturb a community and the way that they affect a community in a long term. Because once again, I think that this is something that is going to have some decently far reaching repercussions as far as
it will.
The way that information is shared, the way that information is vetted, you know, it happened it happened really, really fast with Lou Elizondo and his picture that he posted up in the middle of a speech where he was like, this is a jellyfish UFO that somebody took a picture of. And sent me a picture of it and ended up, no, that was a known image of a chandelier in a hotel.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those like, he trusted that source. He was from the world of intelligentsia. So the fact that he trusted a source so deeply that he did not vet the picture when the source gave it to him, that's the point that we're at in these fields now, Stephen.
We are in this alternative, pyramid or Giza Plateau researchers. You know, I know a bunch of them, but I get to talking with them. I ask them, can a scan be invalid? I ask them that question. They won't say yes and they won't say no.
Yeah.
Isn't that odd? And they also say, I ask, well, can you give an example of a Giza Plateau scan that was wrong? And they just look at you. They're incapacitated by questions that address research methods. I ask, more generally, are there invalid research methods? They can't say yes and they can't say no. because they don't know what a valid research method is. They don't know what an invalid research method is.
Well,
and I ask, well, it's horrific.
There, to bring back the point that we were talking about earlier of peer review and how, yes, it is supposed to be the next step in the scientific method. You know, after gathering data, forming a hypothesis, performing experiments, you know, gathering more data, things like that, you're supposed to pass it on to somebody else. But they're supposed to do like you do, Stephen, and that's ask hard questions. That's ask hard questions about how the data was gathered. They aren't necessarily supposed to be there to confirm what's on the paper. They're supposed to be there as a red team to punch holes in it and see if it still floats.
Right. And people get mad at me when I question these. They say, well, you know, it's how do you dare question it? I say, well, questioning science is called science. And it's just bizarre. I ask them questions. Can two scans be contradictory? They won't say yes and they won't say no. They're just incapacitated. I ask them, what is the hypothesis? Don't know. You know?
Yeah.
And what is causation? That's a great one. Oh, well, we don't do causations. So what this, it's almost like a psyops operation. And the result is it kind of demonstrates just how gullible and ignorant so many alternative researchers seem to be. You know, they are ignorant of valid research methods, which make them gullible to believe it, whatever comes across the pike. So it is, I think, a kind of a revolutionary time in the studies of alternative understanding of the pyramids in Egypt. And people, I think even the general public, is going to understand that a whole bunch of alternative researchers were so easily duped that their credulity is destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember when that happened with the Corey Good situation in the UFO UAP community, when it came to be known that he had lied for many, many years, that, you know, he had basically the blue avians, that he talked about in his experiences were his meditation guides that he created, that if anybody else said that they saw them, that they were delusional, things like that. And for years, he was out at conferences. Gaia had a whole series based on him. And
yes.
And like, that's how far down the rabbit hole these things go. At some point, I would much rather this come to light and come to pass sooner than later. You know, I think the longer it stays in the communities, I think possibly the more damage it will do if it is utterly fake and falsified. And we've seen numerous things that have been fake and falsified over the last many years in these communities, not only things like Corey Good, but, you know, the Peruvian mummies, the fairy skeletons, all kinds of manner of situations. So once again, data is always king. Science is always king. And
I agree.
We really do have to wait for that to come along, because until then, it's hearsay and conjecture. Like you're saying, if we are depending solely on, quote, peer review, are those peers in the same camp, and do they have a vested interest in this moving forward the way it stands, or are they willing to ask the hard questions that may poke enough holes that the hypothesis sinks? You know?
Well, we'll find out.
Yeah.
This is how I think it's going to transpire. These scans are going to be the genesis of a mystery religion, a modern day mystery religion.
Ooh.
And it probably will never go away completely. and people will use a lot of mental gymnastics to keep believing in these structures underneath the pyramids. They'll say, well, yeah. you can't really know they're not there. I've heard that a lot. And that is a logical fallacy called appeal to ignorance. Have you ever heard a Great Pyramid researcher say appeal to ignorance? No, because they don't even know what that means. But I'll give you an example. I can tell you that we don't know. Nikola Tesla didn't say that the Great Pyramid was built using pixie dust and unicorns.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know he didn't say it. So that sort of lends credence to that. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
That's what these guys, you know, try to validate their belief system. So it's the Giza Plateau mystery religion. And it will probably never go away completely. Just like all that idea of the Great Pyramid and Bible correlations will never go away. You know,
there's still the idea of it being a countdown clock, all kinds of things.
Bible prophecy and all of that, because they use a bunch of invalid research methods to come up with falsehoods. And the scan process has so many levels of slop and areas that can introduce error and the manipulation of data and the secrecy involved in the process.
Yeah.
Is a big red flag, and but a lot of people have been duped by it, you know. And like you say, even if it's all true, they should say now, well, we'll find out. But a lot of people say, oh no, it's true. So it's a belief system now, and I hope I go down in history as being one of the first scaninators out there. Do you get my drift?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's one of those, they're claiming extending approximately 2,100 feet deep beneath the pyramid. Yeah. So once again, that is a vast, vast leap over the marriage of tomography and SARS, or and SAR, not SARS. Yeah. Let's don't get vaccines and flus involved.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to get a scan.
We'll really get kicked off the internet then, Stephen.
But it's sad. It gives all of the researchers that are diligent trying to do viable work and scholarly research, it gives them all a black eye, and it takes us away from doing viable research to try to counter this avalanche of falsehoods that these scans have produced. So we'll see how it plays out. I bet a few people or a few researchers will probably have to throw in the towel because of how embarrassing it will be when becomes apparent that they were duped into believing falsehoods instantly.
Yeah, and that, once again, it's something that we talk about on this show all the time, Stephen, literally, is the idea of the want of confirmation married with confirmation bias and the dangers behind that when it comes to research. The willingness to turn a blind eye, the willingness to not ask the hard questions because it may confirm what you believe. It's dangerous. It's dangerous in a lot of ways, not only for standard science, but especially for these adjunct sciences, these sciences. I call them sciences, you know, things like remote viewing, stuff like that. There's plenty of lab work done on that, you know, and unfortunately, even the ideas of, the sensationalism in communities behind that can stop other good research into that from going on and keep good scientists from wanting to touch the research, you know? It's a slippery slope once you start getting involved with sensationalism. And I am one of those who is prone to regularly say, Stephen, let's please make science sexy again. Like, actual science, not pseudosciences, not things that are just hype, stuff like that, but actual good science. Let's start making that sexy to our kids again. Let's start making it attractive again.
That's true. Yeah, it's science is a method to seek truth is what I would say. But when you veer away from legitimate academic research methods, like that have been involved with this, you know, Scantopia phenomenon that's going on right now, a lot of researchers, alternative researchers, will be eating crow and have mud on their face, to say the least. So, and that might be sooner than later, certainly. So we'll see how it all plays out. Yeah. And it's just amazing to me that so many people just accepted it instantly. And all these people, they're not, a SAR experts or anything else. They just bought it hook, line, and sinker. And they're so adamant about how much they believe this to be true. It's like they're having a scangasm. That's another word I made up.
I don't want to see the meme image for it, Stephen.
No, you don't want to see an AI image of a scangasm. So, but that it'll probably be out there now in an hour.
Yeah, right.
But you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? It's just horrible. It puts us all in a bad light. But that's why I jumped right on the bandwagon as soon as I could to risk my reputation on the invalidity of these scans. So we'll see how it all plays out.
Well, and absolutely, I am right there with you. I would pretty well say that what we are looking at is some very doctored information. I don't think it will be repeatable in any way, shape, or form, and I definitely don't think it will be confirmed to having structures, man-made structures the size of the Eiffel Tower underneath the Pyramid of Khafre. I don't see that in the future, folks. I'm very sorry. I think that we may find some additional caverns, some additional ways in which these things are connected to natural cisterns and even possible underground aquifers, that kind of stuff. But I don't see any massive city dwellings or things like that going on underneath the sands of Egypt in that kind of way.
Yes, I talk on like Facebook, for example, to some true believers, and ultimately this city is supposedly underneath the groundwater, if you will, the ground and the water and the water table, excuse me. So, but I say, as soon as you walk in that underground massive city, let me know, and I will say I stand corrected.
Yeah,
but it ain't gonna happen.
As always, I wear my skeptic with my S on my chest for skeptic with pride, and with that large S, Stephen, comes the fact that I am waiting for the data that will change my mind. My mind is open. My mind is ready to be changed. I'll gladly accept it as soon as there is data that satisfies that. And I'm looking for
it. Right. Well,
I'm totally open to it. I don't think that this is it. So
no, wouldn't it be fun though if it was true?
Absolutely,
it would really be. Oh man, and all that stuff, and we could walk around under there and talk to the Nephilim or whatever. So, but guess what? It isn't there. You know.
Yeah.
It'd be really nice if cows could jump over the moon. But, you know, you could read about it in literature and everything else, but it's just not going to happen.
If calves could jump over the moon, they would conquer us, Stephen. Let's don't give them ideas.
Oh, boy. Yeah. but the point, you know, these modern day alternative researchers are about as coherent as cow jump over the moon ologists, if you will. You know, when you try to talk to them, you know, they are the diehard believers and don't let science get in the way.
As I said earlier, the communities get very shark jumpy. They are looking for data. They are looking for confirmation of their data and confirmation of their thought form. And as soon as it comes along, they will snatch it up, and adopt it as their own. And, I hope more data comes out. I hope that there is some challenging data that comes out on this. Stephen, thank you so much for your time tonight. It's always great knocking these things around with you, talking about these things. You are passionate and vehement online about such things. Let everybody know where they can go to not only follow the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, but also to get your new book, The Pharaoh's Pump Analyzed.
Well, thank you for such a wonderful interview, and I had a lot of fun. They can find out more about me, the nonprofit foundation I'm the founder of, at my website at thepump.org. That's thepump.org. And there you'll find my YouTube channel, you know, my Facebook page. And, of course, we have some documentaries and video series that are free to watch online. And, of course, my books, links to my three books that I've that have more information about my direction of research. So just visit thepump.org to as a portal to everything about me and what I'm doing.
Fantastic. Stephen, thank you once again. It's always a pleasure. It's always great chatting with you. I'm so sorry for the technical difficulties. Audience, I'm sorry for the technical hiccups at the beginning of the streams, things like that. While you are online, checking out everything from Stephen Myers and the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation at thepump.org, everybody. You can also find all of these episodes in their entirety at CuriousRealm.com. You can also find the document that we were looking at, Synthetic Aperture Radar Doppler Tomography Reveals Details of Undiscovered High-Resolution Internal Structure of the Great Pyramid of Giza. That is what we were looking at tonight. That is what we were talking about. Thank you so much for tuning into this segment, everybody. When we come back from this break, we will be joined by Marla Wing Cooper. We will be talking about her experience growing up with her uncle, L.D. Cooper, who she later came to find out was actually D.B. Cooper. More on that when we come back right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much to Stephen Myers for coming on and helping break down these new scans of the pyramids. It's mind-blowing what's out there, folks, but you really need to temper it with good science and repeatable science and peer-reviewed science. And that's really what that was all about. So thank you very much, Stephen Myers, for coming on for that. Our guest in this segment is Marla Wynn Cooper. She is the author of DB's Niece, In the Raw and Unedited, The Story of My Hijacked Life. In 1971, everybody, Thanksgiving Day on Northwest Airlines, a man by the name at that point of Dan Cooper, later to be called DB, being misquoted by in the newspaper, they misquoted his name. And that's where we get the name DB Cooper. But on that day, Dan Cooper boarded a Northwest Orient Airlines airplane in Portland, Oregon, going to Seattle SeaTac, and gave the stewardess a note, showed her a bomb, and said, "I need $200,000. And that began what is literally the only unsolved hijacking in American history, one of the only cases that the FBI not only left shelved, but closed, officially closed all of a couple few years ago. I think actually the last time we had Marla Wynn on. So welcome back to the show, Marla Wynn Cooper. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm good.
Absolutely. This has been a fascinating case. I mean, it happened 4 years before I was born, but it was something that I heard growing up my whole life, and it's one that I think fascinates a lot of people, especially here in America. We have a very anti-hero aspect to us, when you look at a lot of the, I guess, quote, folk heroes of the early part of the 1900s, you were looking at people like Bonnie and Clyde. Al Capone, right. Stuff like that. Like, these were people who were revered by society and celebrity. And it's fascinating to think about that. And to think that D.B. Cooper rode that same kind of wave where people literally looked at him like a modern day Robin Hood. The fact that he hijacked a plane, got $200,000 cash, and was never heard from again and never caught. How did you first come to find that you were possibly related to the famed D.B. Cooper, Marla?
Well, let me backtrack just a sure. couple of things that you said in your introduction. One, it was actually Thanksgiving Eve. It yes. wasn't Thanksgiving Day that it happened. And the other thing, the FBI closed the case officially in 2016. It was, I believe, July of 2016.
Okay.
They had told me 5 years before that they were going to close the case because they believed that my uncle was the hijacker and that they would never be able to prove it in a court of law. And so they're just calling it an officially closed cold case, unsolvable. At the time, well, let's see, what year was it? The hijacking was 71. So it was 21. I think you and I have spoken since then that, I found out a lot of these other D.B. Cooper sleuths were told by the FBI also. They knew my uncle was the hijacker. And yet there's this constant, oh, we've got to figure it out. Let's study the evidence a little deeper, blah, blah, blah. But I was an eyewitness to my uncle, Lynn Doyle Cooper, and his brother, my other uncle, Dewey. They were my dad's next two older brothers. And they were planning this hijacking. I didn't know that's what they were planning. They told me they were going turkey hunting. It's something about their behavior was very suspicious. They had a way of communicating with each other, and I will call it mental keep away, where they will share a joke between them, nudging each other, Yeah, we're going to get a turkey. Ha, ha, ha. The kid thinks we're going to get a turkey, you know. So I was out in the woods, literally with them, with their walkie-talkies. I was walking along with my Uncle LD. That's what we called him. His name was Lynn Doyle Cooper. In the woods, out close to my grandmother's house, and my Uncle Dewey went one direction, LD and I went another direction, and every now and then, you know, they would communicate to see if they could hear each other, and then they figured out they were about a mile and a half apart when they really lost connection and could no longer hear each other. I found out from the FBI later that because of their expertise in working in special forces and the Air Force, they were both paratroopers. You know, they had the ability to use landmarks and things like that to know exactly where LD was going to land. The FBI told me he really only had about a mile. Dewey only needed to have a 1.5 mile square area to patrol to find LD after he jumped out of the plane. So, and there were actually a lot of things I've learned. Let me back up. So the day after the hijacking, which was Thanksgiving Day, very, very early in the morning, I was in my grandmother's driveway, probably in the tree that I loved to climb. And I was 8 years old, and my uncles drove up in a car that they had driven away in the day before. And I would jump down out of the tree thinking, okay, there's going to be a turkey in the trunk. And I was like, did you get a turkey? Did you get a turkey? And Dewey said, no, we didn't. And I looked in the car and I could see my Uncle LD in the driver's seat, just bloody, bruised. He was just he was a bloody mess. It was a horrific thing for a little kid to see. And I was pretty traumatized by that. I asked, you know, Dewey, what happened? And he said, we got in a wreck. And I looked at the car and I said, this car is fine. What happened? And he just screamed at me to go get my dad. So I ran in the house to get my father. Dad came outside, goes onto the driveway. And at that time, as I recall, only my father and I were home. I think my mother and grandmother had gone to the restaurant where my grandmother worked to bake pies, get ready for dinner. My grandmother worked in a restaurant and a lot of people ordered pies for their Thanksgiving.
Yep.
And they were making the turkey there. They were just prepping Thanksgiving dinner in the kitchen of this restaurant where my grandmother worked. I believe that my sister and brother were at our other grandmother's house. And because I don't remember anybody else being there except for my dad and I and my two uncles. But I heard their conversation. I heard Dewey telling my dad, we did it. We're rich. We just have to go back and find the money because the money was lost and it's in a field somewhere. You know, it's out in a field. We can go back. We can get it. But we just had to get out of there. And I remember just being elated that we were rich because we had been very poor my whole life. And I remember my dad being extremely angry with both of my uncles, but he was especially mad at Dewey because Dewey was drunk out of his mind. And here was LD, and literally it looked like he could die, like he could bleed to death or something. He was severely injured from the accident. And my dad told him, he said, Dewey, you stupid son of a bitch. You get out of here before mom comes back. You've got to get out of here. Get him somewhere safe. And I do know where they went after this. I learned it from Dewey's stepdaughter. But, you know, that was, my dad sat me down and said, you can never talk about this. This is very serious. Dewey, I mean, he was crying. He said Dewey could die. I mean, LD could be killed for what he did. If they find, if the police find out who, what he has done, they would kill him. It's a matter of life and death. You've got to keep this secret. And I took that really seriously. I'd never seen my dad so intense. Sure. Until about a week later when it was show and tell. And, you know, it'd been all over the news about this hijacking. I didn't make the connection that that guy I was seeing on the TV was supposed to be my Uncle LD. I just remember being mad that the Macy's Day Parade had been canceled. And my grandmother was really upset that LD was missing from the family Thanksgiving dinner. And there was just a lot of tension in the house. But like a week later, we lived in Spokane, Washington at the time. These things happened in Sisters, Oregon, where my grandmother lived. That was like our home base. And, you know, a week later I said, "Hey Dad, you know, everybody's talking about hijackers. Can I tell my class that, you know, at show and tell that my uncle was is a hijacker?" And he sat down and gave me that lecture all over again. And, you know, that time it stuck. I just put it out of my mind. And I, you know, now I wonder if Dad hypnotized me or something. Seriously, I'm not making a joke there. Because I completely forgot about it until a month before he died, when he reminded me of it. And at 59 years old, I had gone home at Christmas time to New Mexico. This is, you know, we moved about a year and a half after the hijacking. We moved to the flatlands of New Mexico, the grass, what do they call it? A grassland. I call it a desert. Prairie. It's a grassland, but it is just a desert. Yeah. It's like, it was so barren and stark and windy and just weird. It felt alien compared to where we'd always lived, which was the Pacific Northwest. And anyway, my father, you know, fast forward, it's 1995, Christmas, and my dad and I are sitting at his kitchen counter, and I, you know, was thinking about family holidays, because here I was, just like a late night trip home for Christmas, like we'd done when I was a kid up until the time I was 10 years old or 9 years old. And I asked him, you know, "Have you ever heard from Uncle LD?" And he said, "No, I haven't." By this time, Dewey'd been dead several years. And I said, "What do you think happened to him? Do you think he's still alive?" He goes, "I think he's still alive." I said, "Well, why doesn't he get in touch with you? Why is he gone? You know, why did he vanish?" And he said, "Well, I think because the FBI and the CIA are still looking for him." And I go, "What?" You know, I just was like, "What are you talking about?" I mean, I just thought that he went through a nasty divorce and needed to get out of town or something, you know. Yeah. But here it is. It's, let's see, that was 95, and he had been gone since Christmas of 72, because he was still around for another year after the hijacking. So it had been 33 years since we'd seen him. And Dad was like, "Yeah, he's there. Don't you remember?" I was like, "Why would they be looking for him?" He said, "Don't you remember? He hijacked that airplane and Dewey helped him." And then suddenly it was like, mentally, I went into some kind of a vortex. I was like, I remember knowing that my uncle was a hijacker, you know, and then I remembered the show and tell thing. And I was like, I remember knowing that, but I don't remember the details. And he's like, "Marla, this is a famous story." And, you know, strangely, I have never been a TV watcher. I mean, every now and then I'll binge watch some television series during COVID or so, but I don't watch a lot of TV. I've at that time, I didn't bother to watch the news at all. I always thought it was just a bunch of bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know?
Sure.
And now we know it's a bunch of bullshit. Anyway, he was like, you need to write a book about this. You know what happened. He said, if you go to the library and look up D.B. Cooper, it'll come back to you. You'll remember what happened. And I said, D.B. Cooper, you know, I was like, why D.B.? He goes, well, it's an unsolved case. And that's what the press called him and whatever. It was, and I was like, this wasn't making any sense. And I thought, my dad has lost his ever loving mind. Mm. And, you know, he called me. I spent Christmas with him and he was really beside himself trying to get through to me how important this was to him. Sure. And I went back to Tulsa after Christmas and sort of put it out of my mind, and he kept calling me. The last time I spoke to him was maybe 2 days before he died, maybe even the day before he died. I mean, it was like,
oh wow,
within hours of his death. He had called my place of employment. He was worried about my brother. He said, I haven't heard from David and I just want to make sure he's okay. And I was like, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, he's right here. He's having lunch with me. You want to talk to him? And David got up and takes the phone call. Yeah, Dad, I'm fine. I'm sorry. I just had to hurry up and get on the road. And my brother and I were both going through divorces at the same time. And my dad had, it was like he was troubled. He was trying to make peace. But before he hung up, Dad was like, Marla, promise me you're going to go look this up. And I want you to write a book about this. And I was like, okay, Dad. Well, then, you know, he's dead like so quickly, so suddenly after that. And, you know, at the risk of sounding like a crazy conspiracy theorist, I've since learned so much about what happens to people who divulge deep state secrets, you know, that it wouldn't surprise me if my dad was taken out. He was healthy. He had high cholesterol, but he was still working and whatever. And, you know, suddenly he was dead after talking about that. So it seems, and I say that because I could just ramble on.
You know, when you find these things out, when something like this comes to you once again through your father reminding you of mm-hmm. something that happened in your childhood, at what point did you start, I guess, really researching D.B. Cooper, some of the things that happened and some of the things that lined up with your uncle?
Yeah, so
specifically skill sets, things like right. that, because there's a, especially to jump out of the plane that he jumped out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The plane yeah. with tail stairs, things like that. Yeah, yeah, 727 with tail with aft stairs that come down. Mm-hmm. That is not a right. common plane to jump out of. Hey, let's go skydiving
yeah.
at the time. but it was a plane that was specifically used in Vietnam.
Yeah.
For air drops. Well, it was Air America, things like that.
It was used exclusively by Air America. And it's my belief that the CIA had the plane designed specifically for this purpose. And so fast forward, it's 2009. It's my mother's 66th birthday. And she had a birthday party and our whole family was there. My brother and his children. I was there with my kids. My sister was there with her boyfriend and my aunt had flown in. It was like this big family gathering like I've not seen since I was a really young child. And it was like, you know, feelings have a memory to them, you know, just like our olfactory nerves. You can smell a
yeah.
flower cologne or something, and it takes you back 30, 40 years like it was 2 minutes ago. Well, yeah. I believe that emotions have the same thing. Family, when you're with your tribe and there's that many of them and all this shared DNA is in one place, it welled up inside of me that, oh my God, this, you know, last time I felt this way was grandma's house. And the last time I really remember feeling this way was that Christmas when my uncle LD was missing from the table. And I said, because he had vanished the Christmas a year after the hijacking. Okay. It was Christmas morning. He got up and left so early that it was the only time in my life we opened Christmas presents on Christmas Eve, and he had given all of us gifts. But I remember saying to my mother, and by this time, you know, my father's been dead for 13 years. When I said, what do you think ever happened to, I said, this feels like we're back in sisters, you know, because that's where we were all from.
Yeah.
And I said, this feels like we're back in sisters. And then I go, hey, it used to be so fun. We get together and dad and his brothers would be playing guitars and they'd be passing the microphones around and singing. And even my grandmother would sing. And I was like, gosh, what do you think ever happened to Uncle LD? And she goes, I don't know. And I don't care if I ever see that son of a bitch again. You know, it's like, I'm good riddance. I'm glad he's gone. I go, she goes, he's probably dead. And I go, why would you say that? You know, because I adored him. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, he was crazy. He was just out of his mind. And I go, what are you talking about? She goes, don't you remember what he was like? I said, well, I remember he had epilepsy. And she goes, well, that's just what we told you kids. Well, he actually really did have epilepsy. But she said, we probably just told you that, you kids, that because he was just so crazy. He would just fly off the handle. And she goes, and besides that, I'm pretty sure he was D.B. Cooper. And I go, who's D.B. Cooper? You know, I'm still not remembering the conversation with my dad. Well, my sister comes out of her kitchen and says, you think Uncle LD was D.B. Cooper? And mom goes, I'm sure he was. That's the only time she said that. I'm sure he was. After that, it was, well, it was just sort of a feeling. You know, when she's talking to the FBI, yeah, I think probably, maybe, I don't know. You know, but at that moment, it was, I am sure he was D.B. Cooper. And I said, who's D.B. Cooper? And my sister looked at me kind of annoyed. She goes, you know, the hijacker. And then suddenly I'm back in that vortex thing again, and I'm at my dad's kitchen counter, and I'm going, Dad reminded me of this. I know what happened. I know what happened. Dad said I knew what happened. I was like, I remember knowing LD was a hijacker. And mom goes, oh, I don't want to talk about it anymore. And she just shut up. She wouldn't say anything. She got really angry when I started to probe her. But then it wouldn't leave me. And I was driving back home with my two older sons, and I pulled up the story of Cooper hijacking. I couldn't even remember the initials at that time. Cooper hijacking. And here comes the composite drawing you just showed. And I was like, oh, my God. And I turned around and I handed my phone to my sons. I go, look at this. And they were like, that looks like Grandpa Don. And I went, yeah, doesn't it? I mean, and of course, it's his brother. And he, you know, then it was like, I could not get it out of my mind for like a solid week. I would get in this like deep meditative state, for lack of a better word, just going back in my memory, remembering childhood events that happened, when they happened. I looked up when the hijacking had happened, and I was going, making a list of all the, because I went to 22 different schools. I mean, my life was just constant upheaval as a child. And I realized we were in Spokane at the time of the hijacking. And then, you know, I remembered this you know, I remembered the morning that he had, I mean, never had I forgotten that the morning he vanished, he had given me this leather hand-tooled belt. He had made hand-tooled leather gifts for the whole family. And I would get, that year we had moved back to Sisters. So the year, school year following the hijacking. And we lived directly behind my grandmother's house. And by that time, LD was living with her and he was convalescing there. He'd been in and out of a, yeah. So that picture of my uncle there with the,
With the tool belt.
With the belts. That was Christmas Eve. He had given all of us those gifts and, my dad got a picture of him with those two guitar straps. I called it a belt. It was, but he gave me a belt, and my belt was not finished because I'd come home after school and watch him tooling leather, and he couldn't work on my gift because just always right there mesmerized watching him doing that. And when he gave it to me, he said, "Maybe someday I'll get to finish this for you." And I mean, I wore that belt and it just kind of embarrassed because it had my name on it and he had colored in three of the letters. Like, I think there was I think the M and the R and the L were colored in, but he hadn't done the A's yet.
Okay.
And I kept it for a really long time. And, anyway, my mother, I consulted with her and she shut down. She went silent. And I told her, I'm going to go to the FBI with this. This is him. You know, this is an unsolved mystery. And, you know, I want to solve it. Dad told me to write a book. I want to do this. I want to make this happen. And she was just like sickened. She was afraid. And I think she had always known he was really the hijacker, and she was afraid of like going to prison for aiding and abetting a criminal like that. And even all those years later, it was, you know, at that point, it was like 38 years. Anyway, a man by the name of Arden Dorney, I called the FBI. They completely ignored me.
Sure.
And like a month or two later, maybe longer than that, I met a man named Arden Dorney. He had been a undercover. Well, I don't want to say what his exact role was. Officially, he worked for the Highway Patrol in El Reno, Oklahoma. But Arden, he was a client of mine. And when I met him, he was talking about just the strangest thing. He had reunited with a sister he'd been estranged from for so long, like 25 years or something. And I think that his mother had died or a family member died and they had seen each other again. And I said, wow, I know what that's like to be estranged from a family member. Mm. And I was thinking I was going to talk about my sister because we go years without speaking to each other. And instead what came out was my Uncle LD. And he goes, you could knock me over with a feather right now. He goes, I just watched a documentary about him just last night. And I said to my wife, I can't believe they never caught this guy. They still don't know who this guy is. And I said, well, the reason they didn't is, you know, I'm like the only living witness to what happened.
Sure.
And I said, he goes, what are you going to do with this? I said, I tried to go to the FBI, but they, you know, just ignored me. And he said, if you want to tell this story, he goes, I can have an agent on your doorstep tomorrow. And I said, well, I want to tell this story, but not tomorrow because I was getting ready to go on a long vacation.
Sure.
Well, when I returned from a trip to Mexico, there was a note on my door of my apartment that said, you know, we'd like to talk to you about your uncle, Lynn Doyle Cooper, and his possible involvement in the Norjak investigation. So I contacted them. I met with Scott Billings, an agent out of Stillwater, Oklahoma. And Scott said, you know, he's putting together information, right?
Yeah.
And we later, Scott and I became friends. I helped Scott through kind of a difficult time in his life after he had retired from the force. And he was a very, he was somebody just so sincere to me. In fact, all of the FBI guys I had dealings with were wonderful people. They were great men. But I would also say they're also men who take orders and they don't question authority. In fact, I think they target young men and women who don't question authority. You follow the orders of whoever's given orders to you and you don't question them. And there's a reason I say that. But Scott did, I don't want to get too wrapped up in the minutia of what happened going through that investigation with the FBI, but I passed the polygraph test telling them, you know, after step after step after step of, you know, knowing what I knew, the big one being the Dan Cooper comic books that my uncle had several of, like, six of them, thumbtacked to the wall of his bedroom in my grandmother's house. And they were written in French. It's about a French Canadian fighter pilot in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And much about the hijacking was modeled after some of the comic books. And when I saw this Dan Cooper comic book, I was like, is this about one of your relatives? And I remember saying, wow, that guy sure looks like Uncle LD. You know, and Uncle LD had these things. And I was like, do you have a cousin named Dan? And, you know, just questioning. And he's like, no, I just collect those. They're just about a fighter pilot. And we would take those thumbtacks down because the kids were always relegated to that room when there were family gatherings. And my cousins and I mean, it was a tiny, tiny bedroom. It was like all bed. And my cousins and I would thumb through that. We couldn't understand it because it was written in French.
Yeah.
And so I remember distinctly that happening. There were other things about, you know, the day following, things my father said that I gave to the FBI. And, you know, they found me to be very credible. They also had looked into LD's background and, you know, knew. But it's funny how they, when you go through an FBI interrogation, they really try to trip you up with information. Sure. Yeah. You know, how do you explain this going on? And I guess that one of the things that really convinced them of my honesty, as Scott Billings told me later, was I was so consistent and I had details. You know, it wasn't like I was just thinking, well, maybe I think, you know, this was kind of weird. No, it was the day of. And then my story went viral on August 1st of 2011. There was a guy, Jeffrey, can't think of his last name right now, but he wrote a book called Skyjacked, I think. I've got the book somewhere. Jeffrey was about to release his book. He was taking pre-orders for it. And the Telegraph came to interview him out of the UK. And they talked to a couple of people who were featured in Jeffrey's book, you know, these so-called sleuths, whatever. And to verify his story, they had gone to the FBI and they spoke to their PR person. And she, you know, and they asked her, is there any movement on this DB Cooper thing? It's so long ago. Have you guys just given up? And she told him, no, we've had our most promising lead ever in this investigation in the Norjet that we're working with. Well, when the Telegraph released that story, it went viral. And I had a friend who was, she was in advertising. They own an advertising agency. And I said, can you get me in touch? I kind of had her on standby. I was like, the FBI has told me they're not going to do anything further to investigate this case. But, you know, and if they don't, I'm going to, you know, these police officers who helped me get the story to the FBI, they're like, we'll go to Fox News, we'll go to the History Channel, we'll go to anybody who will listen to us, and we will vouch for you that you're telling the truth. We know who liars are. You know, you're not a liar. And, you know, they were going to help me break this story. Well, I think it was armed with that information, because that's what I told Curtis Ng, who was the investigator I was working with out of the Seattle field office. I said, if you guys aren't going to do anything, I'm going to go to the media. So they went to the media, which I really wasn't totally prepared for. But my friend, Lauren, reached out to ABC News, because they were the ones to break the story that the Telegraph had. It was just a human interest story, right? It's the last day of July, or I guess it was the 30th of July, right? The 29th of July. They had is when they broke the story that there was this, you know, leak, or that the FBI had confirmed they had a promising lead in the DB Cooper investigation, as reported in the Telegraph. So Lauren reached out to ABC News, the Washington Bureau. They sent an interviewer and producer, film crew out to Oklahoma City the following day and interviewed me. And it aired on Good Morning America the following day. And they had Jeffrey there live. And he just said, oh, we're, you know, as we get closer to the 40th anniversary, we're going to see lots of Maria Coopers or whatever her name is coming out of the woodwork, claiming that their uncle or their cousin or their dad or their brother was D.B. Cooper. I mean, he was just an ass. And I mean, he knew nothing about me. And I think that what shocked him is he had accidentally been given access to the DB Cooper files. Well, he had nothing about me because I was part of an ongoing investigation. And so he'd written this whole book with all these rabbit trails of these different suspects. And a week before his book's coming out, he finds out he knows nothing about me.
Well, and there were quite a few suspects that they had over the years. You know, I mean, Robert Rackstraw was famously one, quite a few. So,
well, Rackstraw was never a serious contender in the eyes of the FBI. It was only, oh God, what's that guy's name? Colbert. He was the guy who worked with the fake History Channel to create this propaganda piece where he follows Bob Rackstraw around for 5 years, ruins the guy's life, literally gives him a heart attack. He's dead in the emergency room from the stress of what the History Channel production company called LMNO, leave my name out, productions. And literally, they destroyed Bob Rackstraw's life. I became really good friends with Bob Rackstraw. I spoke with Bob 3 days before he died.
Oh, wow.
I have his last text wishing me a happy 4th of July. I had gone out to San Diego to speak with him face to face. About a year before he died. It was in February of 2019. And Bob Rackstraw was suing the History Channel, NBC, the Disney, you know, Disney, all that whole conglomerate. He was suing them for $1 billion. He was like, you've destroyed my life. You destroyed my business. Yeah. You've taken, these disabled veterans who were working with him, two of them committed suicide when they lost their livelihoods because of what the History Channel had done to him. Bob told me that some of his friends who were like Navy SEALs and stuff would call him up, you know, because they've got surveillance equipment. We can't even begin to understand. And they said, Bob, why is there a van parked at the end of your marina? It wasn't his marina. He owned a storage facility and he did repairs on yachts, on, you know, great big seafaring vessels. And they were like, why is there a guy out there with this gun and that gun and this gun trained on you while you're trying to work? And he's like, this is those assholes from the History Channel. It's this, is it Tom? I get the other Colbert mixed up, but Tom Colbert, yeah, who accused Rockstraw. And the History Channel does this big old documentary, and at the very end you find out that, you know, the only living witnesses are like, no, that guy doesn't look like him at all. The FBI had ruled Rackstraw out in the 70s. Rackstraw was in jail the night of the hijacking. There's no way he physically could have done it. It was just a big old fat publicity stunt on the part of Tom Colbert. And of course, the History Channel plays along because it's this typical case of look over here and don't look over there. You know, because I had credibility with the FBI. None of my story has ever been aired on any documentary. I mean, they'll take like 10 seconds of me speaking, and then it's like they cut in a strange place, you know, like to make me look like an idiot. Or they'll cut other people vouching for me and you know, make it look like they think I'm nuts. You know, it's terrible. I've lived through what creative editing looks like to keep a narrative going. But in my opinion, those other suspects, the real serious contenders, the people who are doing so-called copycat hijackings all through the 70s, they were part of the same operation. I learned from a retired general in the army, his name was Charles Edmiston, and he has died since. But he told me my uncle ran a supply operation for Air America all through the Cold War years. And he said the hijacking, he said, you really need to look up Gladio 1 and 2. They were CIA operations, and that's what these hijackings were all a part of. And so the other thing that had happened was, which I can speak about now, I could not speak about before, but I, you know, it's funny how Providence intervenes so many times throughout my story. Just the strangest things happened. I learned so much about that hijacking. I mean, I was a wolf in sheep's clothing when I showed up at Jeffrey's seminar. I thought, oh, these people are going to be so happy I've solved the mystery. Well, they hated my guts. And to this day, they're still not fans. They especially didn't like me when the FBI told them, we know Marla's uncle did this. You know, she's the real deal. You guys can keep throwing out, you can keep going down these. They were like, well, you don't have any evidence of that. Well, that was sort of the point. They didn't have any evidence because he married a woman who worked for the FBI, and so did her mother. She didn't work for the FBI at the time of the hijacking, but the evidence disappeared out of the Reno FBI Bureau, which is where it was all gathered up. But by the time it got to Seattle after 9/11, when there were orders for all of the investigative entities, the CIA, the FBI, NSA, we didn't have Homeland Security before that. They're all supposed to communicate, and they never did before then. Well, so here we go. Let's take all the evidence from every case that had multiple bureaus working on it, and we're going to put it at Seattle. And Seattle is where the evidence was brought, but a lot of the evidence was missing. You know, there's this story that, oh, his drink glass just got, you know, put in with the other drink glasses. The cigarette butts that he'd smoked and left on the plane, those were missing from the evidence packet. They're not sure they have the hijacker's real fingerprints. I don't think they do at all, but they bungled it. It was, and I think it was intentional. Well,
they would have his fingerprints plus anybody else who'd sat in that seat since the last time it was cleaned or wiped down.
Exactly.
Which I would venture to guess in 1971 is not quite a protocol the way it is today.
Yeah, today it's like we sterilize, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like the whole place is wiped down with like alcohol wipes before you get into it. But that was not the case in 1971.
It was not the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he, you know, and they, there's, claims that that's the actual necktie, and then other people say that's not the necktie that he wore. I have a picture of my Uncle Wendell in the identical suit to the hijacker, all the way down to the tie clasp, that was taken at my grandfather's funeral in 1964.
And granted, the necktie that the FBI has, you probably could have found that around the neck of any engineer.
It was a Marion Barry. It was a Marion Barry tie.
It's a clip-on thin black necktie, straight black necktie. That is exactly what 95% of your people with pocket protectors wore. Like it is as commonplace as probably the cigarette butt at the time.
I think he wore a different tie altogether.
Because, even the fact that the cigarette butts were collected, it's not like they had DNA evidence at the time.
They knew it was coming. You know, they could say they were saving it, knowing that eventually that would be available, which is why. And also for fingerprinting.
Yeah.
There were fingerprints.
There would be fingerprints on the butts. That is true.
Should have been if they had the butts. But there were in my uncle's closet. I distinctly remember this tie that was woven out of maroon threads and brown threads. You turned it one way and it looked brown. You turned it another way, it looked like deep maroon. It looked, in the dark, it could look black. But some of the eyewitnesses said that he wore a brownish maroon tie or a brown tie or a maroon tie, some of the witnesses. So I suspect he was wearing that tie that I saw in his closet. I mean, he might have been wearing the black tie. Like I said, my uncle LD, I think he got the suit I think LD got the suit from my uncle Wendell. Wendell's wife at the time, when the story broke, she called the FBI and said a bunch of shit that wasn't true. Like, they lived right next door to us at the time of the hijacking. Well, no, that was a year later. But I was like, why would she go to so much trouble to say this? And then the more I thought about it, I was like, I remembered we stopped at my Uncle Wendell's house when he was married to this woman at the time, after we had left Grandma's on the Thanksgiving of the hijacking. And my brother and sister and I were playing outside, but my dad was inside having a really, really serious talk with my Uncle Wendell. And my mother was in there, and so was Charlene, Wendell's wife. And it was like, you kids get out of here. You go outside and play. You don't come back inside. I mean, they did not want us to hear what this conversation was about. Sure. So I think she was covering her ass when she called the FBI and said, Marla's making that up, whatever. But, what I started to say was, there was a man by the name of Mike Coberly. And in my book, I call him the rancher. And I had put together that my uncle had to have been stationed in Laos during the winter of 68 and 69, because that is when when Air America was doing the tests, allowing the Army Rangers and whoever, this collection of special ops, black ops guys, jump out of the airplane. And I figured my uncle must have been there. Although, we don't have access to a real military record of his. He had to have been there because he knew you could skydive out of that plane. There were only a handful of operatives who would have known that. And so I put together that he had to have been in Laos in the winter of 68 and 69 when the test flights were happening. And I had written about that in my book, before publishing. I didn't put my book out until right before the History Channel documentary came out. And I met this man in New Mexico. It was so strange. I was driving up to the mountains from Oklahoma City. It was Memorial Day weekend. And I'm going up there to work on my book. And it's 20, 2014. I don't remember exactly the year. I really have to put my head down and think about it. But a friend of mine asked me to stop in Clayton, New Mexico, where I went to high school. She said, "We're all here having, you know, family reunion. Stop in and, you know, say hello to everybody." Well, there was a terrible storm. So they were inside of this big barn that one of their family members owned. And I get there. It is a rainstorm of all rainstorms that night. And we're inside of this barn. And my friend, Diana, says, "I want to introduce everybody to my friend, Marla Cooper." Diana's a karaoke queen, let me tell you. She's got her microphone. "Hey, everybody, my friend Marla's here." And she's working on a book about her uncle. He was a real D.B. Cooper. Well, this really sweet lady comes up to me and says, "Marla, I really want you to meet my husband." He's followed that story this entire, you know, ever since it happened. Sure. And I think, okay, it's just somebody who's, you know, knows about the D.B. Cooper hacking. That's what I'm expecting. Well, here's this older man wearing overalls, and he's got, I think he had a t-shirt or a tank top or something on. I mean, it was muggy in there. And he said, I don't remember exactly what he was wearing except for the overalls. And I said, she brings him over, and it's pretty evident he's had a stroke. And she said, "Mike, this is Marla. Marla, this is my husband, Mike." And I said, "Well, hi, Mike." And I bent down to shake his hand. I said, "I understand you knew my uncle, or you knew about the hijacking." And he says, "Yes, ma'am, I knew your uncle." He was gripping my hand at the time. And I've never had anybody look so intently into my eyes. And I said, "You knew my uncle? How did you know him?" And, you know, I'm literally about to faint because I'm in the desert of New Mexico. Sure. And I'm like, how the hell does this guy, if it's true, and everything within me was telling me, he's telling me the truth. How do you know him? He said, "We worked together." I said, "Who did you work for?" He said, "We worked for Air America. It was the CIA. And I go, "Yeah, I know who Air America is." I said, "When did you work with him? And where were you?" And he said, "Well, we were in Laos together." And I said, "When was that?" And he said, "It would have been the winter of 68 and 69. And the next day, I took a friend of mine over, to make a long story short. Well, this is a really important part of the story, actually. Mm. This man's name, I can now share it because he passed away a few months ago. And his family has given me permission to disclose who he is. And I have a video of him and I sitting together in their garage. That's where they hang out, with the garage door open. You get a good wind block there. And I'm talking to him about what he remembers about my uncle. And he said he had become an Army Ranger when he was like 18 years old. He was very young. But he was telling me, you know, things about his history. And he said, "You know..." Well, he told me, he said, "We were together and we were securing an area of the jungle where the CIA was bringing in these helicopters and dropping these huge bales of some white substance." He goes, "And we never knew what it was." He goes, "It might have been drugs." Well, yeah. I'm pretty sure it was drugs. And he said, "They would drop things off and they'd pick things up." And he said, "We were up in trees with our guns watching for anybody who tried to come into this part of the jungle because we'd shoot at their feet, get them out of there." He said, "You know, we really didn't have to kill anybody. Once they knew we were in this area, they would the locals would avoid going in there." And he said, "But we were there together for 2 whole months, wow, the two of us." And he described a scar on my Uncle LD's back that was really, really deep. He said, "When you saw that you'd think that kind of a scar should have killed a man. And he said, your uncle was nothing but muscle and bone. And he said, the rest of us who were there working on this mission, he said, we looked up to him like he was some kind of a deity. It's like he was a god. He said he was a lot older than the rest of us, but he had been on many, many missions working for the CIA. And I said, why didn't you come forward? And he said, you don't tell secrets when you do this kind of work. And I said, how do you know? I said, are you sure that the same guy was my uncle? He said, you know, the night that the hijacking happened, I looked up, I'm watching the TV, and I see those drawings of him. He didn't use the word composites. I saw those drawings. He said, they didn't really look like him, but they looked enough like him. I knew who that was. And I turned to my wife and I said, well, I'll be damned. That's old Linus. And Chris, at this point, my friend who was videotaping us, you see me just like the blood goes out of my face. Because when he said Linus, I flashed back to that day with the walkie-talkies when Dewey was saying, can you hear me, Linus? Come in, Linus. And I was like, Linus? Why is he calling you Linus? I knew the name Linus only from the Peanuts comic strips, sure. Right? And he said, well, that wasn't really his name, but that's the name I gave him. And it stuck. And I said, well, it sure did stick because my Uncle Dewey was calling him that. And then they made me not call him because I started calling him. Yeah, come on, Linus. And then when we got back to the house, they were like, that's a secret name. You don't tell anybody that name. And I remembered it because I remember saying, well, if you're Linus, Uncle Dewey is Pigpen, because my Uncle Dewey was just a slob. And LD was rather fastidious about himself. You know, his hair was always greased back and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it was that code name Linus that eventually got me to this General Edmiston.
Yeah.
When Mike Coberly told me he would not be able to participate in the History Channel documentary that was being made, because he had said he would, and then he said, I just can't risk it. He said, even with them changing my voice and doing a silhouette or blurring my face or whatever, he said, they will know who I am and they will kill me. Or, you know, at the very least, they would take away all of my benefits. And as broken as I am, I need these benefits. Yeah. Mike Coberly had suffered a stroke. He suffered several strokes and had three brain surgeries. The last one, they removed a third of his brain and froze it to take shrapnel out of his brain that had been in there since the Vietnam era. But Mike Coberly giving me that code name led me to another encounter with someone on the very day that Mike told me I cannot share this story. It was February the 15th of 2016. I think it was 2016 that the documentary came out. So it was the February before when he said that, I had gone to a friend's house for a birthday party and met someone who worked in, he's in logistics and he does a lot of moving for the government, very high, high, high level security clearance. And it was that very day that I met this guy and he's like, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm participating in a History Channel documentary that's being made. I've authored a book that I'm about to release. And he said, what's your book about? And I said, well, my uncle was D.B. Cooper. And he goes, are you kidding me? I followed that story since I was a little kid. You know, he just on and on and on and on.
Well,
and I said, I wonder if with your security clearance, you might be able to help me because I have a code name that was used, my uncle used, And, you know, I tell him this really briefly, and he pulls his phone out. He goes, I might be able to help you with that. And he starts taking it. He said, I need your phone number. And the next day he called me. I mean, when I say Providence intervened, nobody would believe all the stories that happened along the way. But it turned out that Ed knew this general who had always talked about Linus, this amazing operative named Linus. And he said, he's told me about Linus as long as I've known him, which was 25 years. And he said, I'm going to reach out to him and see if he can help you. And the very next day, I had a conversation with General Charles Edmiston, who filled me in on all of this information. Wow. He was also interviewed for 45 minutes for that documentary. The History Channel was putting the 4-hour documentary.
Oh, I'm sure.
Not 1 second of his testimony was aired.
Yeah.
You would think if they wanted to tell the truth, this would be relevant information, but no.
Possibly. And you know, that's the thing. Documentaries follow their own line of what they want to do, and that's just kind of how they work. It's kind of sad in that way frequently, but your book has always been amazing to me. It's in our store. Mm-hmm. Let everybody know where they can go to get their copy of it, aside from Curious Realm.
You can get it on Amazon. It's very expensive to print because there are a lot of photos in there. I recommend downloading the Kindle version. And also, they scrubbed the image of where the transcript from the flight, when there's a break in the flight, that actually in the transcript script at the exact point that they've acknowledged, you know, accidentally, I think that they knew who the hijacker was. So they scrubbed that photo. I had a picture of that photo, and now I can no longer find the flight transcripts. But wow. I would love to find that and send it to you. I think I have it in my book notes because I didn't realize until like a couple of years ago that that page was missing. It says something like insert photo here. They took it out of my book.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah. Thank you so much for your time tonight, Marla. It's always great to talk with you and catch up. An amazing story that really just still kind of baffles in a lot of ways how they just didn't follow certain clue lines. So thank you so much for your time. It's always great talking with you.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Well, while you are online checking out DB's Niece, In the Raw, Unedited, The Story of My Hijacked Life by Marla Wynne Cooper. Folks, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find all of the books, movies, and classes from our guests. That is also where you can find your official copy of The Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, UFO, UAP, cryptozoology, this is your pocket field log to write down all of your data in real time as it occurs in the field. So you are ready to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, as always, for tuning in. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourself, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.